sheen around the table. They could search for 1,000 years in there, especially if the power's off and they don't know how to bring it back up, which I'm assuming they don't. And you do, of course, the machine said. Yes, Hawser said, I do. We can turn the power on at one of 3 stations, this one, number 7, or number 1. It still works. Woobslin looked sceptical. Well, it was working when I left. Deep geothermal producing electricity. The power shafts are sunk about 100 kilometres through the crust. Anyway, as I say, there's too much space down there for those Idirans and Medjel to have a hope of searching properly without some sort of detection device. A mass anomaly sensor is the only one that'll work, and they can't have one. We have 2. That's why we have to go in.
And fight, Duralo said.
Probably not. They've taken communicators. I'll get in touch with them and explain who I am. Naturally, I can't tell you the details, but I know enough about the Idiran military system, about their ships, even some of their personnel, to be able to convince them I am who I say I am. They won't know me personally, but they were told a changer would be sent later.
Liar,
Malveda said. Her voice was cold. Hawser felt the atmosphere in the mess change, become tense. The culture woman was looking at him, her features set, determined, even resigned.
Balveda, he said softly. I don't know what you were told, but I was briefed on the Hand of God, and Zoralundra told me the Idiran ground force in the Chihertsi knew I'd been sent for. He said it calmly.
Okay.
That wasn't what I heard, Balveda said, but he sensed she was not totally sure of herself.
She had risked a lot to say that, probably hoping that he would at least threaten her or do something which would turn the others against him. It hadn't worked.
Hawser shrugged. I can't help it if the Special Circumstances section can't brief you accurately, Peristek, he said, smiling thinly.
The culture agent's eyes looked away from the changer's face, at the table, then at each of the other people sitting around it, as though testing them to see who they each believed.
Look, Hawser said in his most honest-sounding and reasonable voice, spreading his hands out. I don't want to die for the Idirans, and God knows why, but I've come to like you lot. I wouldn't take you in there on a suicide mission. We'll be all right. If the worst comes to the worst, we can always pull out. We'll take the cat back through the quiet barrier and head for somewhere neutral. You can have the ship. I'll have a captured culture agent.
He looked at Balveda, who was sitting in her seat with her legs crossed, her arms folded and her head down. But I don't think it'll come to that. I think we'll catch this glorified computer and be well rewarded for it.
What if the cultures won the battle outside the barrier, and they're waiting for us when we come out, with or without the mind? Yalsin asked.
She didn't sound hostile, just interested. She was the only one he felt he could rely on, though he thought Woobslin would follow too.
Hawser nodded. That's unlikely. I can't see the culture falling back all over this volume but holding out here. But even if they did, they'd have to be very lucky indeed to catch us. They can only see into the barrier in real space, don't forget, so they'd have no warning of where we'd be coming out. No problem there.
Yalsin sat back, apparently convinced. Hawser knew he looked calm, but inside he was tensed up, waiting for the mood of the rest to make itself clear. His last answer had been truthful, but the rest were either not the whole truth or lies. He had to convince them. He had to have them on his side. There was no other way he could carry out his mission, and he had come too far, done too much, killed too many people, sunk too much of his own purpose and determination into the task to back out now. He had to track the mine down. He had to go into the command system, Idirans or no Idirans, and he had to have the rest of what had been Kraklin's free company with him. He looked at them, at Yalsin, severe and impatient, wanting the talking to stop and the job just to be got on with, her shadow of hair making her look both very young, almost childlike, and hard at the same time. Duralo, her eyes uncertain, looking at the others, scratching one of her convoluted ears nervously. Woobslin, slumped comfortably in his seat, compressed, his stocky frame radiating relaxation. Woobslin's face had shown signs of interest when Hawser described the command system, and the changer guessed the engineer found the whole idea of this gigantic train set fascinating. Avager looked very dubious about the whole venture, but Hawser thought that now he'd made it clear nobody was going to be allowed to stay on the ship, the old man would accept this rather than go to the trouble of arguing about it. Nysin, he wasn't sure about. He had been drinking as much as ever, been quieter than Hawser remembered him,
But while he didn't like being bossed around and told what he could and couldn't do, he was obviously fed up being stuck on the clear air turbulence and had already been out for a walk in the snow while Webslin and Hawser were looking at the Medjel suit. Boredom would make him follow, if nothing else. Hawser wasn't worried about the machine, Unahar Klosp. It would do as it was told, like machines always did. Only the culture let them get so fancy they really did seem to have wills of their own. As for Peristek Balveda, she was his prisoner. It was as simple as that.
"Easy in, easy out," Yalsin said.
She smiled, shrugged, and looking round at the other said, "What the fuck? Something to do, isn't it?" Nobody disagreed. Hawser was reprogramming the cat's fidelities once more, entering the computer's new instructions through a worn but still serviceable touchboard, when Yalsin came onto the flight deck. She slipped into the co-pilot seat and watched the man as he worked. The touchboard's illuminated display threw the shadows of Moraine characters over his face. After a while, she said, looking at the markings on the illuminated board,
"Moraine, eh?"
Hawser shrugged. "It's the only accurate language I and this antique share." He tapped some more instructions in. "Hey," he turned to her, "you shouldn't be in here when I'm doing this." He smiled to show her he wasn't serious.
"Don't you trust me?"
Yalsin said, smiling back. "You're the only one I do," Hawser said, turning to the board again. "It doesn't matter anyway for these instructions."
Yalsin watched him for a little longer. "Did she mean a lot to you, Hawser?"
He didn't look up, but his hands paused over the touchboard. He stared at the illuminated characters.
"Who?" "Hawser,"
Yalsin said gently. He still didn't look at her. "We were friends," he said, as though talking to the touchboard.
"Yeah, well," she said after a pause, "I suppose it must be pretty hard anyway, when it's your own people."
Hawser nodded, still not looking up. Yalsin studied him for a little longer.
"Did you love her?"
He didn't reply immediately. His eyes seemed to inspect each of the precise, compact shapes in front of him, as though one of them concealed the answer. He shrugged.
"Maybe," he said. "Once."
He cleared his throat, looked briefly round at Yalsin, then leaned back to the touchboard.
"That was a long time ago."
Yalsin got up then, as he went back to his task, and put her hands on his shoulders.
"I'm sorry, Hawser."
He nodded again and placed one hand over hers.
"We'll get them," she said, "if that's what you want.
You and..." He shook his head, looked round at her. "No. We go for the mind. That's all. If the Adirans do get in the way, I won't care. But... no. There's no point in risking more than we have to. Thanks, though." She nodded slowly.
"That's all right."
She bent, kissed him briefly, then went out. The man gazed at the closed door for a few moments, then turned back to the board full of alien symbols. He programmed the ship's computer to fire warning, then lethal laser shots at anybody or anything approaching it unless they could be identified by the distinctive electromagnetic emission signature of the suit as one of the Free Company. In addition, it required Hawser's, Craiklin's, identity ring to make the cat's elevator work and, once on board, to take control of the ship itself. Hawser felt safe enough doing this. Only the ring would let them take over the ship, and he was confident nobody could take that from him, not without a greater risk to themselves than even a squad of mean and hungry Adirans could provide. But it was possible that he might be killed, and the others might survive. Especially for Yalsin, he wanted them to have some sort of escape route that didn't depend totally on him. They took down some of the plastic boarding in the changer base so that if they did find the mine, they'd be able to get it through. Doralo wanted to bury the dead changers, but Hawser refused. He carried each of them to the tunnel entrance and left them there. He would take them with him when they left, return them to Habor. The natural freezer of Shah's world's atmosphere would preserve them until then. He looked down at Kirikel's face for a moment, in the waning light of late afternoon, while a bank of clouds coming in from the frozen sea built over the distant mountains and the wind freshened. He would get the mind. He was determined to, and he felt it in his bones. But if it came to a firefight with the ones who had done this, he wouldn't shrink from it. He might even enjoy it. Perhaps Balveda wouldn't have understood, but there were Idirans and Idirans. Zorilundra was a friend, and a kind and humane officer. He supposed the old Quirl would be considered a moderate, and Horza knew others in the military and diplomatic missions whom he liked. But there were Idirans who were real fanatics, who despised all other species. Zorilundra would not have murdered the changers. It would have been unnecessary and inelegant. But then, you didn't send moderates on missions like this. You sent fanatics, or a changer. Horza returned to the others. He got as far as the crippled flyer, now surrounded with the plastic boarding they had removed, and facing the hole in the accommodation section as though he was about to enter a garage, when he heard firing. He ran through the corridor leading to the rear of the section, readying his gun. "What is it?" he said into his helmet mic.
"Laser, down the tunnel from the shafts," Yalson's voice said.
He ran into the open storeroom area where the others were. The hole they had opened in the plastic boarding was 4 or 5 meters wide. As soon as Horza came through from the corridor, flame splashed from the wall alongside him, and he saw the brief air glows of laser tracks just to one side of his suit, leading back through the gap in the wall and down the tunnel. Obviously, whoever was doing the shooting could see him. He rolled to one side and came up by Doralo and Balveda, who were sheltering by a large portable winch. Holes burst through the wall of plastic boards, burning brightly then going out. The whoop of laser fire echoed down the tunnels. "What happened?" Horza said to Doralo. He looked around the storage area. The rest were all there, taking cover where they could, apart from Yalson.
"Yalson went,"
Doralo began, then Yalson's voice cut in. "I came through the hole in the wall and got shot at. I'm lying on the ground, I'm okay, but I'd like to know if it's all right to fire back. I won't damage anything, will I?" "Fire!" Horza yelled, as another fan of glowing tracks spattered a line of burning craters over the inside wall of the storeroom. "Fire back!"
"Thanks," Yalson said.
Horza heard the woman's gun snap, then the Doppler echo of sound produced by superheated air. Explosions crashed from down the tunnel. Yalson said.
"Think that's got..."
Nysin said from the far side of the storage area. His voice cut off as more fire slammed into the wall behind him. The wall was pockmarked with dark, bubbling holes.
"Bastard," Yalson said.
She fired back in short, rapid bursts. "Keep his head down," Horza told her. "I'm coming forward to the wall. Doralo, stay here with Balveda." He got up and ran to the edge of the hole in the plastic boards. Smoking holes in the material showed how little protection it afforded, but he knelt there in its cover anyway. He could see Yalson's feet a few meters out into the tunnel, spread on the smooth, fused floor. He listened to her gun firing, then said, "Right, stop long enough to let me see where it's coming from, then hit it again."
"Okay."
Yalson stopped firing. Horza stuck his head out, feeling incredibly vulnerable. Saw a couple of tiny sparks far down the tunnel and off to one side. He brought the gun up and fired continually. Yalson started again as well. His suit chirped, a screen lit up by his cheek, showing he'd been hit on the thigh. He couldn't feel anything. The side of the tunnel, far down at the elevator shafts, pulsated with 1,000 sparks of light. Nysin appeared at the other side of the gap in the boards, kneeling like Horza and firing his projectile rifle. The side of the tunnel detonated with flashes and smoke. Shockwaves blew up the tunnel, shaking the plastic boarding and ringing in Horza's ears.
"Enough!" he shouted.
He stopped firing. Yalson stopped. Nysin put in one final burst, then stopped too. Horza ran out through the gap, across the dark rock floor of the tunnel outside, and over to the side wall. He flattened himself there, getting some cover from the slight protrusion of a blast door's edge further down the tunnel. Where their target had been, there was a scatter of dull red shards lying on the tunnel floor, cooling from the yellow heat of the laser fire which had torn them from the wall. On the helmet night sight, Horza could see a series of rippling waves of warm smoke and gas flowing silently under the roof of the tunnel from the damaged area.
"Yalson, get over here," he said.
Yalson rolled over and over until she bumped into the wall just behind him. She got quickly to her feet and flattened out beside him.
"I think we got it," Horza broadcasted.
Nysin, still kneeling at the gap in the boarding, looked out, the rapid-fire micro-projectile rifle waving to and fro as though its owner expected a further attack from out of the tunnel walls. Horza started forward, keeping his back to the wall. He got to the edge of the blast door. Most of its meter-thick bulk was stowed in its recess in the wall, but about half a meter protruded. Horza
looked down the tunnel again. The wreckage was still glowing, like hot coals scattered on the tunnel floor. The wave of hot black smoke passed overhead, wafting slowly up the tunnel. Hauser looked to his other side. Yalson had followed him. "Stay here," he said. He walked down the side of the wall to the first of the elevator shafts. They had been firing at the third and last one, judging by the grouping of the craters and scars all around its open, buckled doors. Hauser saw a half-melted laser carbine lying in the middle of the tunnel floor. He poked his head out from the wall, frowning. Right on the very lip of the elevator shaft, between the scarred and holed doors, surrounded by a sea of dull, red-glowing wreckage, he was sure he could see a pair of hands. Gloved, stubby-fingered, injured. One finger was missing from the glove nearer him, but hands without a doubt. It looked like somebody was hanging inside the shaft by the tips of their fingers. He focused the tight beam of his communicator, aiming in the direction he was looking at. "Hello?" he said in Adiran. "Megel. Megel in the elevator shaft. Do you hear me? Report at once." The hands didn't move. He edged closer. "What was it?" Wobslin's voice came through the speakers. "Just a moment," Hauser said. He went closer, rifle ready. One of the hands moved slightly, as though trying to get a better grip on the lip of the tunnel floor. Hauser's heart thudded. He went toward the tall open doors, his feet crunching on the warm debris. He saw semi-seated arms as he went closer, then the top of a long, laser-scarred helmet. With a rasping noise he had heard Megel make when they charged during a battle, a third hand, he knew it was a foot, but it looked like a hand, and it was holding a small pistol, flashed up from the elevator shaft at the same time as the Megel's head looked up and out, straight at him. He started to duck. The pistol cracked, its plasma bolt missing him by only a few centimeters. Hauser shot quickly, ducking and going to one side. Fire blew out all around the lip of the elevator, smashing into the gloves. With a scream, the gloved hands vanished. Light flickered briefly in the circular shaft. Hauser ran forward, stuck his head between the doors and looked down. The dim shape of the falling Megel was lit by the guttering fire still burning on its suit gloves. Somehow, it still held the plasma pistol. As it fell, screaming, it fired the small weapon, the cracks of its shots and the flashes from the bolts drawing further away as the creature holding it, firing it, whirled, its six limbs flailing, down into the darkness.
"Horza?" Yalson shouted. "Are you all right? What the fuck was that?"
"I'm fine," he said. The Megel was a tiny, wriggling shape, deep in the shaft's tunnel of vertical night. Its screams still echoed, the microscopic sparks of its burning hands and the firing plasma pistol still flaring. Hauser looked away. A few small thuds recorded the hapless creature's contact with the sides of the shaft as it dropped.
"What's that noise?" Duralo said.
"The Megel was still alive. It shot at me, but I got it," Hauser told them, walking away from the open elevator doors. "It fell. It's still falling, down the elevator shaft."
"Shit,"
breathed Nysin, still listening to the faint, fading, echoing screams.
"How deep is that?"
10 kilometers if none of the blast doors are shut," Hauser said. He looked at the external controls for the other two lifts and the transit capsule entrance. They had escaped more or less undamaged. The doors leading to the transit tubes were open. They had been closed when Hauser inspected the area earlier. Yalson shouldered her gun and walked down the tunnel toward Hauser.
"Well," she said, "let's get this ARP on the road."
"Yeah," Nysin said. "What the hell? These guys aren't so tough after all. That's one down already."
"Yeah, deep down," Yalson said.
Hauser inspected the damage to his suit while the others came down the tunnel. There was a burn on the right thigh, a millimeter deep and a couple of finger breadths wide. Save for the unlikely chance of another shot falling on the same place, it hadn't harmed the suit.
"A fine start, if you ask me," the drone muttered as it started down the tunnels with the others.
Hauser went back to the tall, buckled, pitted doors of the lift shaft and looked down. With the magnifier up full, he could just make out a tiny, sparkling, deep, deep below. The helmet's external mics picked up a noise, but from so far away and so full of echoes, it sounded like nothing more than the wind, starting to moan through a fence. They clustered in front of the open doors of an elevator shaft,
not the one the Medjel had fallen down. The doors were twice the height of any one of them, dwarfing them all as though they were children. Hawser had opened those doors, taken a good look, floated down on the suit's AG a little way, then come back up. It all looked safe. "I'll go first," he told the assembled group. "If we hit any trouble, let off a couple of chaff grenades and get back up here. We're going to the main system level, about 5 kilometers down. Once we get through the doors, that's us more or less in Station 4. From there, we'll be able to turn on the power, something the Adirans haven't been able to do. After that, we'll have transport in the form of transit tube capsules."
"What about the trains?" Wubslin asked.
"The transit tubes are faster," Hawser said. "We might have to start a train up if we capture the mine. Depends exactly how big it is. Besides, unless they've moved them since I was here, the nearest trains will be at Station 2 or Station 6, not here. But there is a spiral tunnel at Station 1 we could bring a system train up."
"What about the transit tube up here?" Yarsen said. "If that's the way that Medjel suddenly appeared, what's to stop another one hiking up the tunnel?"
Hawser shrugged. "Nothing. I don't want to fuse the doors closed in case we want to come back that way once we have the mine. But if one of them does come up that way, so what? It'll be one less down there for us to worry about. Anyway, somebody can stay up here until we're all safely down the lift shaft, then follow us. But I don't think there'll be another one so close behind that one."
"Yes, that one you didn't manage to talk into believing you were both on the same side," the drone said testily.
Hawser squatted down on his haunches to look at the drone. It was invisible from above because of the pallet of equipment it was carrying. "That one," he said, "didn't have a communicator, did it? Whereas any Adirans down there certainly will have the ones they took from the base, won't they? And Medjel do as Adirans tell them to, right?" He waited for the machine to reply, and when it didn't, he repeated, "Right?" Hawser had the impression that had the drone been human, it would have spat.
"Whatever you say, sir," the drone said.
"And what do I do, Hawser?" Malveda said, standing in her fabric jumpsuit, wearing a fur jacket on top. "Do you intend to throw me down the shaft and say you forgot I didn't have any AG? Or do I have to walk down the transit tunnel?"
"You'll come with me."
"And if we hit trouble, you'll..."
"What?"
Malveda asked. "I don't think we'll hit any trouble," Hawser said.
"You're sure there are no AG harnesses in the base?" Avager said.
Hawser nodded. "If there had been, don't you think one of the Medjel we've encountered so far would have had them on?"
"Maybe the Adirans are using them."
"They're too heavy."
"They could use 2, Avager insisted.
"There were no harnesses," Hawser said through his teeth. "We were never allowed any. We weren't supposed to go into the command system apart from yearly inspections when we could power everything up. We did go in. We walked down the spiral to Station 4 like that Medjel must have slogged up, but we weren't supposed to, and we weren't allowed gravity harnesses. They'd have made getting down there too easy."
"Damn it, let's get down there," Yarsen said impatiently, looking at the others.
Avager shrugged.
"If my AG fails with all this rubbish I'm carrying," the drone began, its voice muffled by the pallet over its top surface.
"You drop any of that stuff down that shaft and you'd be as well to follow it, machine," Hawser said. "Now just save your energy for floating, not talking." "You'll follow me. Keep 500 or 600 meters up. Yarsen, will you stay up here till we get the doors open?" Yarsen nodded. "The rest of you," he looked round them, "come after the drone. Don't bunch up too much, but don't get separated. Wubslin, stay at the same level as the machine and have chaff grenades ready." Hawser held his hand out to Malveda.
"Madame?"
He held Malveda to him. She rested her feet on his boots, facing away from him. Then Hawser stepped into the shaft, and they descended together into the night dark depths.
"See you at the bottom,"
Nysin said in the helmet speakers.
"We're not going to the bottom, Nysin,"
Hawser sighed, shifting his arm slightly round Balveda's waist.
"We're going to the main system level. I'll see you there."
"Yeah, okay, wherever."
They fell on AG without incident, and Hawser forced open the doors at the system level 5 kilometers below in the rock. There had been only one exchange with Balveda on the way down, a minute or so after they had started out.
"Hawser?"
"What?"
"If any shooting starts, from down there, or anything happens and you have to let go, I mean, drop me."
"What, Balveda?"
"Kill me. I'm serious, shoot me. I'd rather that than fall all that way."
"Nothing," Hawser said after a moment's thought, "would give me greater pleasure." They dropped into the chill stone silence of the tunnel's black throat, clasped like lovers.
God damn it, Hauser said softly.
He and Wubslin stood in a room just off the dark, echoing vault that was Station 4. The others were waiting outside. The lights on Hauser and Wubslin's suits illuminated a space packed with electric switching gear. The walls were covered with screens and controls. Thick cables snaked over the ceiling and along the walls, and metal floor plates covered conduits filled with more electrical equipment. There was a smell of burning in the room. A long, black, sooty scar had printed itself onto one wall, above charred and melted cabling. They had noticed the smell on their walk through the connecting tunnels from the shaft to the station. Hauser had smelled it and felt gall rise in his throat. The odour was faint and could not have turned the most sensitive of stomachs, but Hauser had known what it meant. "Think we can mend it?" Wubslin asked. Hauser shook his head. "Probably not. This happened once on a yearly test when I was here before. We powered up in the wrong sequence and blew that same cable run. If they've done what we did, there'll be worse damage further down in the deeper levels. Took us weeks to repair it." Hauser shook his head. "Damn," he said. "I guess it was pretty smart of those Adirans to figure out as much as they did," Wubslin said, opening his visor to reach in and scratch his head awkwardly. "I mean, to get this far." "Yes," Hauser said, kicking a large transformer. "Too goddamn smart."
They made a brief search of the station complex, then gathered again in the main cavern and crowded round the jury-rigged mass sensor Wubslin had removed from the clear air turbulence. Wires and light fibres were tangled about it, and attached to the top of the machine was a cannibalised screen from the ship's bridge, now plugged directly into the sensor. The screen lit up. Wubslin fiddled with its controls. The screen hologram showed a diagrammatic representation of a sphere with three axes shown in perspective.
"That's about 4 kilometres, Wubslin said.
He seemed to be talking to the mass sensor, not to the people around it.
"Let's try 8.
He touched the controls again. The number of lines on the axes doubled. One very faint smudge of light blinked near the edge of the display.
"Is that it?" Dorolo said. "Is that what it is?"
"No," Wubslin said, fiddling with the controls again, trying to get the little patch of light to become clearer. "Not dense enough." Wubslin doubled the range twice more, but only the single trace remained, submerged in clutter. Hauser looked round, orienting himself with the grid pattern shown on the screen.
"Would that thing be fooled by a pile of uranium?"
"Oh, yeah,"
Wubslin said, nodding. "The power we're putting through it, any radiation will upset it a bit. That's why we're down to roughly 30 kilometres maximum anyway, see? Just because of all this granite."
"Yeah. If there's a reactor, even an old one, it'll show up when the sensor's reader waves get to it. But just like this is a patch. If this mine's only 15 metres long and weighs 10,000 tonnes, it'll be really bright, like a star on the screen."
"Okay," Hauser said. "That's probably just the reactor down at the deepest surface level."
"Oh," Wubslin said. "They had reactors too."
"Back up," Hauser said. "That one was for ventilation fans if the natural circulation couldn't cope with smoke or gas. The trains have reactors too, in case the geothermal failed."
Hauser checked the reading on the screen with a built-in mass sensor in his suit, but the faint trace of the backup reactor was out of its range.
"Should we investigate this one?"
Wubslin asked, his face lit by the glowing screen. Hauser straightened up, shaking his head.
"No," he said wearily, "not for now."
They sat in the station and had something to eat. The station was over 300 metres long and twice the width of the main tunnels. The metal rails the command system trains ran on stretched across the level floor of fused rock in double tracks, appearing from one wall through an inverted U and disappearing through another, toward the repair and maintenance area. At either end of the station, there were sets of gantries and ramps which rose almost to the roof. Those provided access to the two upper floors of the trains when they were in the station, Hauser explained, when Nysin asked about them.
"I can't wait to see these trains," Wubslin mumbled, mouthful. "You wouldn't be able to see them if there's no light,"
Avager told him.
"I think it's intolerable that I have to go and carry all that junk," the drone said. It had set the equipment-loaded pallet down, and now I'm told I have to carry even more weight.
"I'm not that heavy, Unahar Klosp," said Balveda.
"You'll manage," Hauser told the machine.
With no power, the only thing they could do was use their suits AG to float along to the next station. It would be slower than the transit tube, but quicker than walking. Balveda would have to be carried by the drone.
"Hauser,
I was wondering, Yalson said.
What?
How much radiation have we all soaked up recently?
Not much. Hawser checked the small screen inside his helmet. The radiation level wasn't dangerous. The granite around them gave off a little, but even if they hadn't been seated up, they'd have been in no real danger. Why?
Nothing, Yalson shrugged. Just with all these reactors and this granite and that blast when the bomb went off in the gear you vacked from the cat, well, I thought we might have taken a dose. Being on the megaship when Lam tried to blow it apart didn't help either, but if you say we're okay, we're okay.
Unless somebody's particularly sensitive to it, we haven't got much to worry about.
Yalson nodded.
Hawser was wondering whether they should split up. Should they all go together, or should they go in two groups, one down each of the foot tunnels which accompanied the main line and the transit tube? They could even split up further and have somebody go down each of the six tunnels which led from station to station. That was going too far, but it showed how many possibilities there were. Split up, they might be better placed for a flanking attack if one group encountered the Adirans, though they wouldn't initially have the same firepower. They wouldn't be increasing their chances of finding the mind, not if the mass sensor was working properly, but they would be increasing their chances of stumbling into the Adirans in the first place. Staying together, though, in the one tunnel, gave Hawser a feeling of claustrophobic foreboding. One grenade could wipe them out. A single fan of heavy laser fire would kill or disable all of them. It was like being set a cunning but unlikely problem in one of the Habor Military Academy's term exams. He couldn't even decide which way to head. When they'd searched the station, Yalson had seen marks in the thin layer of dust on the foot tunnel floor leading to Station 5, which suggested the Adirans had gone that way. But ought they to follow, or should they go in the opposite direction? If they followed, and he couldn't convince the Adirans he was on their side, they'd have to fight. But if they went in the other direction and turned the electricity on at Station 1, they'd be giving power to the Adirans as well. There was no way of restricting the energy to one part of the command system. Each station could isolate its section of track from the supply loop, but the circuitry had been designed so that no single traitor or incompetent could cut off the whole system. So the Adirans, too, would have use of the transit tubes, the trains themselves, and the engineering workshops. Better to find them and try to parley, settle the issue one way or the other. Hawser shook his head. This whole thing was too complicated. The command system with its tunnels and caverns, its levels and shafts, its sidings and loops and crossovers and points seemed like some infernal closed-circuit flowchart for his thoughts. He would sleep on it. He needed sleep now, like the rest of them. He could sense it in them. The machine might get run down, but it didn't need sleep, and Balveda still seemed alert enough. But all the rest were showing signs of needing a deeper rest than just sitting down. According to their body clocks, it was time to sleep. He would be foolish to try to push them further. He had a restrainer harness on the pallet. That should keep Balveda secure. The machine could stand guard, and he would use the remote sensor on his suit to watch for movement in the immediate area where they slept. They ought to be safe enough. They finished their meal. Nobody disagreed with the idea of turning in. Balveda was trussed in the restrainer harness and barricaded in one of the empty storerooms off the platform. Unahar Klosp was told to sit itself up on one of the tall gantries and stay still unless it heard or saw anything untoward. Hawser set his remote sensor near where he would sleep, on one of the lower girders of a hoist mechanism. He had wanted a word with Yalson, but by the time he had finished making all these arrangements, several of the others, including Yalson, had fallen asleep already, lying back against the wall or laid out on the ground, their visors blanked or their heads turned away from the weak lights of the others' suits. Hawser watched Wubslin wander around the station for a bit. Then the engineer too lay down, and everything was still. Hawser switched the remote sensor on, primed to alarm if it sensed anything above a certain low level of movement. He slept fitfully. His dreams woke him. Ghosts chased him in echoing docks and silent deserted ships, and when he turned to face them, their eyes were always waiting like targets, like mouths, and the mouths swallowed him, so that he fell into the eye's black mouth, past ice rimming it, dead ice rimming the cold, swallowing eye. And then he wasn't falling, but running, running with a leaden, pitch-like slowness through the bone cavities in his own skull, which was slowly disintegrating. A cold planet riddled with tunnels, crashing and crumpling against a never-ending wall of ice until the wreckage caught him and he fell, burning into the cold eye tunnel again. And as he fell, a noise came from the throat of the cold ice eye and from his own mouth and chilled him more than ice, and the noise said,
State of Play 3 Fal Angistra was where she liked being most, on top of a mountain. She had just made her first real climb since she'd broken her leg. It was a relatively unforbidding peak, and she had taken the easiest route. But now, here at the summit, drinking in the view, she was dismayed at how unfit she'd become. The healed leg hurt a little, deep inside, of course, but so did the muscles in both legs, as though she'd just climbed a mountain twice the height and with a full pack. Just out of condition, she guessed. She sat on the summit of the ridge, looking out over smaller white summits to the sharp forested creases of the higher foothills and the rolling downs beyond, where grassland and trees combined. In the distance was the plain, rivers sparkling in the sunlight, and, marking its far side, the hills where the lodge was, her home. Birds wheeled far away in the high valleys beneath her, and sometimes light glinted from the plain as some reflective surface moved. A part of her listened to the distant bone ache, assessing it, then switched the nagging sensation off. She wanted no distractions. She hadn't climbed all this way just to enjoy the view. She'd come up here for a purpose. It meant something to climb, to haul this sack of bones and flesh all this way, and then look, then think, then be. She could have taken a flyer here any time when she'd been recovering, but she hadn't, even though Jace had suggested it. That was too easy. Being here wouldn't have meant anything. She concentrated, her eyelids drooping, going through the quiet internal chant, the unmagical spell that called up the spirits buried in her genifixed glands. The trance came on with an initial rush of dizzying force that made her put her hands out to each side, steadying herself when she didn't need steadying. The sounds in her ears, of her own blood coursing, of her breath's slow tide, loudened, took on strange harmonies. The light beyond her eyelids pulsed in time to the blood beat. She felt herself frown, imagining her brow creasing like the folding hills, and one part of her, still distant, watching, thought, "Still not very good at this." She opened her eyes, and the world had changed. The far hills were forever rolling brown and green waves with a crest of breaking white foam. The plain fumed with light. The pattern of pastureland and copses in the foothills looked like camouflage, moving but not moving, like a tall building seen against quick clouds. The forested ridges were buckled divisions in some huge, busy tree brain, and the snow and ice-covered peaks about her had become vibrating sources of a light that was sound and smell as well. She experienced a dizzying sense of concentricity, as though she was the nucleus of the landscape. Here, in an inside-out world, an inverted hollowness. Part of it. Born here. All she was, each bone and organ, cell and chemical and molecule and atom and electron, proton and nucleus, every elementary particle, each wavefront of energy from here, not just the orbital, dizzy again, touching snow with gloved hands, but the culture, the galaxy, the universe.
"This is our place, and our time, and our life, and we should be enjoying it. But are we? Look in from outside, ask yourself, just what are we doing? Killing the immortal, changing to preserve, warring for peace, and so embracing utterly what we claimed to have renounced completely for our own good reasons."
Well, it was done. Those people in the culture who had really objected to the war were gone. They were no longer culture. They were not part of the effort. They had become neutrals, formed their own groupings, and taken new names, or claimed to be the real, true culture. Yet another shading of confusion along the culture's inchoate boundaries. But for once, the names did not matter. What did matter was the disagreement and the ill feeling produced by the split.
Ah, the contempt of it, the glut of contempt we seem to have achieved,
our own disguised contempt for primitives, the contempt of those who left the culture when war was declared for those who chose to fight the adherents, the contempt so many of our own people feel for special circumstances, the contempt we all guess the minds must feel for us, and elsewhere. The Adirons' contempt for us, all of us humans, and human contempt for changes. A federated disgust, a galaxy of scorn. Us, with our busy, busy little lives, finding no better way to pass our years than in competitive disdain. And what the Adirons must feel toward us. Consider. Near immortal, singular and unchanged. 45,000 years of history on one planet, with one all-embracing religion, philosophy. Whole, steady eons of contented study. A calm age of devotion on that one worshipped place, uninterested in anything outside. Then, millennia ago, in another ancient war, invasion. Suddenly finding themselves pawns in somebody else's squalid imperialism. From introverted peacefulness, through ages of torment and repression. A forging force indeed, to extroverted militancy, determined zeal.
Who could blame them? They had tried to keep themselves apart and been shattered, almost made extinct, by forces greater than those they could muster. No surprise that they decided the only way to protect themselves was to attack first, expand, become stronger and stronger, push their boundaries as far from the treasured planet of Idia as possible.
And there is even a genetic template for that catastrophic change from meek to fierce, in the step from breeder to warrior. Oh, a savage and noble species, justifiably proud of themselves and refusing to alter their genetic code. Not far wrong in claiming perfection already. What they must feel for the swarming biped tribes of humankind.
Repetition, matter and life, and the materials that could take change, that could evolve, forever repeating. Life's food talking back to it.
And us, just another belch in the darkness. Sound, but not a word, noise without meaning. We are nothing to them, mere bioautomatons, and the most terrible example of the type. The culture must seem like some fiendish amalgam of everything the Adirans have ever found repugnant. We are a mongrel race, our past a history of tangles, our sources obscure, our rowdy upbringing full of greedy, short-sighted empires and cruel, wasteful diasporas. Our ancestors were the lost and found of the galaxy, continually breeding and breeding and milling and killing their societies and civilizations, forever falling apart and reforming. There had to be something wrong with us, something mutant in the system, something too quick and nervous and frantic for our own good or anybody else's. We are such pathetic, fleshy things, so short-lived, swarming and confused and dull, just so stupid to an Adiran. Physical repugnance, then. But worse to come. We are self-altering. We meddle with the code of life itself, re-spelling the word which is the way. The incantation of being. Interfering with our own inheritance and interfering in the development of other people's. An interest we share. And worst still, worst of all, not just producing but embracing and giving ourselves over totally to the ultimate anathema. The minds, the sentient machines, the very image and essence of life itself desecrated, idolatry incarnate. No wonder they despise us. Poor, sick mutations that we are, petty and obscene, servants of the machine devils that we worship. Not even sure of our own identity. Just who is culture? Where exactly does it begin and end? Who is and who isn't? The Adirans know exactly who they are. Purebred, the one race, or nothing. Do we? Contact is contact, the core. But after that, the level of gene affixing varies. Despite the ideal, not everybody can mate successfully with everybody else. The minds? No real standards. Individuals, too, and not fully predictable, precocious, independent. Living on a culture-made orbital or in a rock, another sort of hollowed world. Small wanderer? No. Too many claiming some kind of independence. No clear boundaries to the culture, then. It just fades away at the edges, both fraying and spreading. So who are we?
The buzz of meaning and matter about her, the mountain song of light, seemed to rise around her like a cauldron tide, drenching and engulfing. She felt herself as the speck she was, a mote, a tiny, struggling, imperfect chip of life, lost in the surrounding waste of light and space. She sensed the frozen force of the ice and snow around her and felt consumed by the skin-burning chill of it. She felt the sun beat and knew the crystals fracturing and melting, knew the water as it dripped and slithered and became dark bubbles under ice and dewdrops on the icicles. She saw the fronded trickles, the tumbling streams and the cataracted rivers. She sensed the winding and unwinding loops as the river slowed and oxbowed, calm, estuarial, into lake and sea where vapour rose once more. And she felt lost within it,
dissolved within it, and for the first time in her young life was truly afraid, more frightened there and then than she had been when she'd fallen and broken her leg, during either the brief moments of falling, the stunning instant of impact and pain, or the long cold hours afterward, crumpled in the snow and rocks, sheltering and shivering and trying not to cry. That was something she had long before prepared herself for. She knew what was happening. She had worked out the effects it might have and the ways she might react. It was a risk you took, something you understood. This was not, because now there was nothing to understand, and maybe nothing, including her, to understand it.
Help!
Something wailed inside her. She listened and could do nothing.
We are ice and snow. We are that trapped state. We are water falling, itinerant and vague, ever seeking the lowest level, trying to collect and connect. We are vapour, raised against our own devices, made nebulous, blown on whatever wind arises. To start again, glacial or not.
She could come out. She felt the sweat bead on her brow, sensed her hands create their own moulds in the crisp, crunching snow, and knew there was a way out, knew she could come down, but with nothing. Having found nothing, done nothing, understood nothing. She would stay then. She would fight it out. The cycle began again, her thoughts looping, and she saw the water as it flowed down gorges and valleys, or collected lower in trees, or fell straight back to lakes and the sea. She saw it fall on meadowland and on the high marshes and the moors, and she fell with it, terrace to terrace, over small lips of rock, foaming and circling. She felt the moisture on her forehead start to freeze, chilling her, and knew the danger. Wondered again whether to come out of the trance, wondered how long she had sat here, whether they were watching over her or not. She felt dizzy again, and grabbed deeper at the snow around her, her gloves pressuring the frozen flakes, and as she did that, she remembered. She saw the pattern of frozen foam once more. She stood again beside that ledge on the moor's cold surface, by the tiny waterfall and the pool where she'd found the lens of frothed ice. She remembered holding it in her hands, and recalled that it did not ring when she flicked it with her finger, that it tasted of water no more, when she touched it with her tongue, and that her breath blew across it in a cloud, another swirling image in the air. And that was her. That was what it meant. Something to hold on to.
Who are we?
Who we are. Just what we're taken as being. What we know and what we do. No less, no more. Information being passed on. Patterns, galaxies, stellar systems, planets, all evolve. Matter in the raw changes, progresses in a way. Life is a faster force, reordering, finding new niches, starting to shape. Intelligence, consciousness, an order quicker, another new plane. Beyond was unknown, too vague to be understood. Ask a Draazen, perhaps, and wait for the answer. All just refining, a process of getting it more right, if right itself was right. And if we tamper with our inheritance, so what? What is more ours to tamper with? What makes nature more right than us? If we get it wrong, that's because we are stupid, not because the idea was bad. And if we are no longer on the breaking edge of the wave, well, too bad. Hand on the baton. Best wishes, have fun. Everything about us, everything around us, everything we know and can know of is composed ultimately of patterns of nothing. That's the bottom line, the final truth. So, where we find we have any control over those patterns, why not make the most elegant ones, the most enjoyable and good ones, in our own terms? Yes, we're hedonists, Mr. Bora Horza Gobachul. We seek pleasure and have fashioned ourselves so that we can take more of it, admitted. We are what we are. But what about you? What does that make you? Who are you? What are you? A weapon. A thing made to deceive and kill by the long dead. The whole subspecies that is the changes is the remnant of some ancient war, a war so long gone that no one willing to tell recalls who fought it, or when, or over what. Nobody even knows whether the changes were on the winning side or not. But in any event, you were fashioned, Horza. You did not evolve in a way you could call natural. You are the product of careful thought and genetic tinkering and military planning and deliberate design. And war. Your very creation depended on it. You are the child of it. You are its legacy. Changer, change yourself.
But you cannot. You will not. All you can do is try not to think about it. And yet the knowledge is there, the information implanted, somewhere deep inside. You could, you should, live easy with it, all the same. But I don't think you do. And I'm sorry for you, because I think I know now who you really hate.
She came out of it quickly, as the supply of chemicals from glands in her neck and brainstem shut off. The compounds already in the girl's brain cells began to break down, releasing her. Reality blew around her, the breeze freshening cold against her skin. She wiped the sweat from her brow. There were tears in her eyes, and she wiped them too, sniffing and rubbing her reddened nose. Another failure, she thought bitterly. But it was a young, unstable sort of bitterness, a kind of fake, something she assumed for a while, like a child trying on adult clothes. She luxuriated in the feeling of being old and disillusioned for a moment, then let it drop. The mood did not fit. Time enough for the genuine version when she was old, she thought, wryly, smiling at the line of hills on the far side of the plain. But it was a failure, nevertheless. She had hoped for something to occur to her, something about the Adirons or Balveda or the Changer or the war or anything. Instead, old territory, mostly, accepted facts, the already known. A certain self-disgust at being human, an understanding of the Adirons' proud disdain for her kind, a reaffirmation that at least one thing was its own meaning, and a probably wrong, probably over-sympathetic glimpse into the character of a man she had never met and never would meet, who was separated from her by most of a galaxy and all of a morality. Little enough to bring down from the frozen peak. She sighed. The wind blew, and she watched clouds mass far along the high range. She would have to start down now if she was going to beat the storm. It would seem like cheating not to get back down under her own steam, and Jace would scold her if conditions got so bad she had to send for a flyer to pick her up. Fal and Geestra stood. The pain in her leg came back, signals from her weak point. She paused for a moment, reassessing the state of that mending bone, and then, deciding it would hold up, started the descent toward the unfrozen world below. Chapter 11. The Command System. Stations. He was being shaken gently.
Wake up now. Come on. Wake up. Come on now. Up you get.
He recognized the voice as Zoralundra's. The old Adiran was trying to get him to wake up. He pretended to stay asleep.
I know you're awake. Come on now. It's time to get up.
He opened his eyes with a false weariness. Zoralundra was there, in a bright blue circular room, with lots of large couches set into alcoves in the blue material. Above hung a white sky with black clouds. It was very bright in the room. He shielded his eyes and looked at the Adiran. What happened to the command system? He said, looking around the circular blue room.
That dream is over now. You did well. Passed with flying colours. The Academy and I are very pleased with you.
He couldn't help but feel pleased. A warm glow seemed to envelop him, and he couldn't stop a smile appearing on his face. Thanks, he said. The Quirl nodded.
You did very well as Borohosa Gobachul, Zoralundra said in his rumbling great voice. Now you should take some time off and go and play with Girashel.
He was swinging his feet off the bed, getting ready to jump down to the floor when Zoralundra said that. He smiled at the old Quirl. Who? He laughed.
Your friend, Girashel,
the Adiran said. You mean Kirakel? He laughed, shaking his head. Zoralundra must be getting old.
I mean Girashel,
the Adiran insisted coldly, stepping back and looking at him strangely.
Who is Girashel?
You mean you don't know? But how could you get her name wrong? He said, shaking his head again at the Quirl's foolishness. Or was this still part of some test?
Just a moment, Zoralundra said.
He looked at something in his hand which threw coloured lights across his broad, gleaming face. Then he slapped his other hand to his mouth, an expression of astonished surprise on his face, as he turned to him and said,
Oh, sorry,
and suddenly reached over and shoved him back into the... He sat upright. Something whined in his ear. He sat back down again slowly, looking round in the grainy darkness to see if any of the others had noticed. But they were all still. He told the remote sensor alarm to switch off. The whine in his ear faded.
Unaha Klosp's casing could be seen high on the far gantry. Horza opened his visor and wiped some sweat from his nose and brows. The drone had no doubt seen him each time he woke up. He wondered what it was thinking now, what it thought of him. Could it see well enough to know that he was having nightmares? Could it see through his visor to his face, or sense the small twitches his body made while his brain constructed its own images from the debris of all his days? He could blank the visor out. He could set the suit to expand and lock rigid. He thought about how he must look to it. A small, soft, naked thing writhing in a hard cocoon, convulsed with illusions in its coma. He decided to stay awake until the others started to rise. The night passed, and the Free Company awoke to darkness and the labyrinth. The drone said nothing about seeing him wake up during the night, and he didn't ask it. He was falsely jolly and hearty, going round the others laughing and slapping backs, telling them they'd get to Station 7 today, and there they could turn on the lights and get the transit tubes working. "Tell you what, Wobslin," he said, grinning at the engineer as he rubbed his eyes, "we'll see if we can get one of those big trains working, just for the hell of it."
"Well," Wobslin yawned, "if that's all right."
"Why not?" Horza said, spreading his arms out. "I think Mr. Adequate's leading us to it. He's turning a blind eye to this whole thing. We'll get one of those super trains running, eh?"
Wobslin stretched, smiling and nodding. "Well, yeah, sounds like a good idea to me."
Horza smiled widely, winked at Wobslin, and went to release Belveda. It was like going to release a wild animal, he thought, as he shifted the empty cable drum he had used to block the door. He half expected to find Belveda gone, miraculously escaped from her bonds and disappeared from the room without opening the door. But when he looked in, there she was, lying calmly in her warm clothes, the harness making troughs in the fur of the jacket and still attached to the wall Horza had fixed it to.
"Good morning, Perestek," he said breezily.
"Horza,"
the woman said grumpily, sitting slowly upright, flexing her shoulders and arcing her neck.
20 years at my mother's side. More than I care to think of as a gay and dashing young blade indulging in all the pleasures the culture has ever produced. 1 or 2 of maturity. 17 in contact and 4 in special circumstances have not made me pleasant to know or quick to wake in the mornings. You wouldn't have some water to drink, would you? I've slept too long. I wasn't comfortable. It's cold and dark. I had nightmares I thought were really horrible until I woke up and remembered what reality was like at the moment. And I mentioned water a moment or 2 ago. Did you hear? Or aren't I allowed any?
I'll get you some, he said, going back to the door. He stopped there. You're right, by the way. You are pretty off-putting in the morning.
Belveda shook her head in the darkness. She put one finger in her mouth and rubbed it around on one side as though massaging her gums or cleaning her teeth. Then she just sat with her head between her knees, staring at the jet-black nothing of the cold rock floor beneath her, wondering if this was the day she died. They stood in a huge semicircular alcove carved out of the rock and looking out over the dark space of Station 4's repair and maintenance area. The cavern was 300 metres or more square, and from the bottom of the scooped gallery they stood on to the floor of the vast cave, littered with machinery and equipment, was a 30-metre drop. Great cradle arms capable of lifting and holding an entire command system train were suspended from the roof above, another 30 metres up in the gloom. In the mid-distance, a suspended gantry lanced out over the cave, from a gallery on one side to the other, bisecting the cavern's dark bulk. They were ready to move. Horza gave the order. Wobslin and Nysin each headed down small side tubes toward the main command system tunnel and the transit tubeway respectively, using AG. Once in the tunnels, they would keep level with the main group. Horza switched on his own AG, rose about a metre from the floor, and floated down a branch tunnel of the foot gallery, then started slowly forward, down into the darkness, toward Station 5, 30 kilometres away. The rest would follow him, also floating. Belveda shared the pallet with the equipment. He smiled when Belveda sat down on the pallet. She suddenly reminded him of Fui Song sitting on his heavy-duty litter in the space and sunlight of a place now gone. The comparison struck him as wonderfully absurd. Horza floated along the foot tunnel, stopping to check the side tubes as they appeared and contacting the others whenever he did so. His suit sensors were turned as high as they would go. Any light, the slightest noise, an alteration in the airflow, even vibrations in the rock around him, all were catered for. Unusual smells would register too, as would power flowing through the cables buried in the tunnel walls and any sort of broadcast communication. He'd thought about signalling the adherents as they went along, but decided not to. He'd sent one short signal from Station 4 without receiving a reply, but to send more on the way would be to give too much away if, as he suspected, the adherents were not in a mood to listen. He moved through the darkness as though sitting on an invisible seat, the cruise cradled in his arms. He heard his heartbeat, his breathing, and the quiet slipstreaming of the cold, half-stale air around his suit. The suit registered vague background radiation from the surrounding granite, punctuated by intermittent cosmic rays. On the faceplate of the suit's helmet, he watched a ghostly radar image of the tunnels as they unwound through the rock. In places, the tunnel ran straight. If he turned, he could see the main group following half a kilometre behind him. In other places, the tunnel described a series of shallow curves, cutting down the view provided by the scanning radar to a couple of 100 meters or less, so that he seemed to float alone in the chill blackness. At Station 5, they found a battleground. His suit had picked up odd scents. That had been the first sign, organic molecules in the air, carbonized and burned. He'd told the others to stop, gone on ahead cautiously. Four dead Medjel were laid out near one wall of the dark, deserted cavern, their burned and dismembered bodies echoing the formation of frozen changer corpses at the surface base. Idirin religious symbols had been burned onto the wall over the fallen. There had been a firefight. The station walls were pocked with small craters and long laser scars. Hauser found the remains of one laser rifle smashed, a small piece of metal embedded in it. The Medjel bodies had been torn apart by hundreds more of the same tiny projectiles. At the far end of the station, behind the half-demolished remains of one set of access ramps, he found the scattered components of some crudely manufactured machine, a kind of gun on wheels like a miniature armoured car. Its mangled turret still contained some of the projectile ammunition, and more bullets were scattered.